This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, BJ Novak, became famous in his mid-20s for playing Ryan on the NBC series The Office, where his character had an on-again, off-again relationship with Kelly Kapoor, Mindy Kaling's character. Novak was also a writer, director, and executive producer of The Office. He was in Quentin Tarantino's film, Inglourious Basterds, and in Saving Mr. Banks. He also wrote a best-selling collection of short stories called One More Thing. Now BJ Novak has a new TV series that he created called The Premise. He's also the primary writer and director of the show. It's streaming on FX on Hulu. The Premise is an anthology series with each half-hour episode dealing with a current issue like social media obsession, the gun lobby, how celebrities are seen as gods. Each episode ends with a surprise twist. Let's start with a clip from the episode called Social Justice Sex Tape. The episode stars Ben Platt as Ethan Stryber, a young man who was watching his sex tape featuring him and a girlfriend, when he noticed that in the corner of the screen, through his window, you could see a young black man being assaulted by police. That young man is now standing trial, wrongly accused of assaulting the police. Ethan decides to come forward and offer his tape as evidence that the man is innocent. As helpful as the tape is for the defense, it makes the jurors cringe and avert their eyes because Ethan looks so awkward and kind of clueless. Then the prosecutor plays excerpts of the tape while interrogating Ethan, which turns into a humiliating critique of his sexual ability and his credibility. Here's how he responds when the prosecutor asks why he was watching the tape. The music you'll hear in the background is from the sex tape.
I guess I was lonely and I had some work I was avoiding doing, so I was procrastinating, I guess.
So the woman on the tape, identified as Vanessa Delacorte, is, well, there's really no other way to say this, much more attractive than you.
Objection. Opinion, not fact.
Overruled. I'll allow it as fact.
Had you two had sex before?
Yeah, obviously.
And she willingly engaged in that again?
Uh-huh.
747, please. Well, you can see he is completely missing her entire area there. It's just not adding to it, is it? Now, you have a lot of black friends, don't you, Mr. Stryber?
Yeah, of course, a ton.
Well, is it possible that the man in the purple hoodie could be one of your friends? Perhaps a fellow crisis actor?
Crisis actor?
Finally!
Tell us, Ethan, what is the name of the folder that you keep this video in?
Unreal.
And what is the connection of the content of Unreal?
This album in my phone where I keep all my, you know, everybody's got that place where they keep all the stuff that gets you.
Fantasies?
Yeah, exactly.
That maybe never happened, that are maybe unreal.
Are they gonna believe this video was fake?
Which is more likely? A man who looks like this, who had sex with a woman who looks like that in the most profoundly bizarre manner, or a millennial incel who is so desperate to be a hero to his progressive peers that he might have fabricated a deep fake that is exactly what he says it is. Unreal.
BJ Novak, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the new series. That scene is really funny.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
How did you start thinking about how a sex tape could inadvertently be used as evidence in a police assault against a young black man?
Everyone that I know, and myself included, thinks of themselves as a good person and says all the right things publicly and believes them, that they support all the right causes. But the irony is it only makes us look better. It's the opposite of a sacrifice to proclaim your alliance to a trendy, even if correct, cause. So I was thinking, well, what if to really make a difference, you looked bad. You didn't look cool, and you had to sort of go through the opposite of that. So the idea that someone would find in the back of a sex tape that they would rather die than have public is something that would actually make a difference to me was very funny and very funny because it asked a question that I thought would be very interesting to try to answer.
One episode is about a rock star who returns to his high school to donate $1 million to the library. And he also makes an unusual offer to the valedictorian. And part of the story is about what he imagined it would be like back when he was in high school if he could return as a famous person and say what he really thought of all the students who had been mean to him when he was in high school. Was that a fantasy you had in high school?
I did want to sort of transcend things that I thought, you know, I think pains and slights. I had a good time in high school. I went to a good high school, and I didn't want to give everyone two middle fingers as this character had always fantasized. But I know what it's like to want to prove people wrong. And I think, you know, he didn't do that when he came back to his school at the end, and he was disappointed that he didn't, because he had moved on. I think there is something bittersweet when we outgrow the revenge. You know, revenge is a dish best served cold, and then maybe, you know, the waiter took it away before he had a chance to eat it. There can even be a remorse about regret. Sounds like a very heady show. I mean, the plot is that he offers to have sex with the valedictorian as an incentive prize. So, you know, all of these ideas are, you know, in the background of what I try to make funny stories.
Before we talk about The Office, because I do want to talk with you about that, I want to talk with you a little bit about how you started in comedy. I know that you wrote for the Harvard Lampoon, and there have been several alums of the Lampoon who went on to Saturday Night Live. Was that an ambition of yours, that it would be a kind of jumping off point to write for Saturday Night Live?
Yes, I applied many times. I wanted to write, it wasn't necessarily Saturday Night Live, it was Saturday Night Live, Conan, The Simpsons. I mean, these were just reverential places to be to me. And so that was why I wanted to go to Harvard, honestly, is because I read once that that's where all those people came from. And that's what I wanted to do.
How close did you get?
I don't know. You ask Lorne Michaels. I don't think he ever heard of me. I don't think I got that far.
So you didn't get a response from any of the shows that you just mentioned?
You know, it's like agents probably like, oh, they liked it, but they went in another direction. Well, if they liked it a lot, they would have gone in my direction. That's what I always think.
That's right. You started in stand-up. And I think you started right after 9/11. Do I have that right?
Yes.
That is a really terrible time to start in comedy.
Well, I didn't know that. And that was reflected in the early responses to my material, which I thought, you know, okay, let's make fun of what's happening in the news. But no.
What were some of your material like?
You know, they were ironic. I mean, it wasn't good. It was, you know, I was trying to be ironic or make the opposite of the joke you'd expect me to make. You know, it was overthought. It was really a lesson. I mean, I had been a good student. I had been, you know, the smart kid who wanted so badly to be in comedy. And so many of my lessons after that were about, it's not about thinking, you know, it's about getting somewhere deeper and you know, being funny in a real way. And so I think a lot of my early jokes were very sort of cerebral.
So did you feel like this is not for me, I can't do it?
Well, the first time I ever performed, which was October 10th, 2001, was at the Hollywood Youth Hostel in Los Angeles. Most people had trouble with English. They were international people. The person before me did a silent impression of Robert De Niro in the bathroom. And that's really what worked. When I got off stage, the MC transitioned into the next act by saying, takes a lot of courage to get up here.
Oh, so, gosh, that hurts.
Yeah. No, it hurts. And, you know, I went through a lot. You bomb a lot as a comic. And you learn to listen to the audience a lot.
But you don't want the MC to acknowledge, like, have sympathy on this guy. It's hard to do.
No, that's, yeah. No, that was about as bad a response as you could get.
Did you try to engage the audience and either berate them for not laughing or, you know, start sweating and trying harder to make them laugh, which only made it worse?
I think I recited everything I had memorized with no interaction. It was, yeah, you know, there's a lot of hard times when you try to do stand-up.
How do you recover from that?
You get on stage again. You get on stage again is the answer.
And what if it happens again?
Well, it will happen again. But, you know, the first time I did stand-up, I couldn't get on stage for another 3 months. And then when I did, I decided I'm going to book 5 shows this week. And I'm going to get on stage no matter what, because I can't let each show be a referendum on whether I do this at all. You know, I need to just, and, you know, the first night I did well, the second night I didn't, the third night I did okay. You know, and I realized, oh, okay, you have to do this a lot. I didn't do stand-up for that many years, but it feels like all of my formative lessons are from that, you know, brutally exposed and honest trial and error in front of an audience.
When you were trying to be a stand-up comic, did you meet a lot of successful comics and get advice from them?
Yeah. I mean, the most memorable one was Louis C.K., who gave me these profuse compliments, and then for all the things I was doing, which were, you know, one-liners and observational bits, and then I immediately heard him on an interview, maybe your show, about a month later, where he said, I'm never doing one-liners or observational bits again. I'm only telling stories from my life. And then he became, you know, a stratospherically successful comic. And I thought, oh, wait, when is that going to happen to me? You know, because I do wonder if I go back on stage again, I would want to try to have some second phase like that. But that was the most interesting compliment, because I knew who he was. He wasn't yet that big a name, but he was very respected among comics, and he praised me for everything he then said he thought was trivial. That was a fascinating sort of head spinning thing.
Let's talk about The Office, which is it crazy to you how popular it is now and how it's kind of streaming all over and syndicated in various places? I mean, even if you didn't want to watch it, you'd probably end up seeing it. It's like all over.
It's so much bigger than it was at the time. And, you know, it was popular, but it's a phenomenon now.
As it should be. It's really just such a great show. How did you get the part as Ryan on The Office?
I was doing stand-up at the Hollywood Improv, and Greg Daniels, who created the show, saw me perform. And I was doing one-liners, essentially, and pausing between the jokes. He told me afterwards that it was my first joke that got him, which was, I learned nothing in college. It was really kind of my own fault. I had a double major, psychology and reverse psychology. And and he said it was that joke, but then when he met me, he said, you know, it was really the pauses between your jokes, because I have this idea for this temp character who kind of thinks he's better than everyone. And in those pauses, you had a little arrogance that I thought was very funny. So that's actually what got me the part. And then he had heard that I very much wanted to be a writer. So he offered to read my script as well, my spec script, which all writers carried around then. And I got hired for both jobs at the same time. And then Mindy Kaling was hired for both as well, too.
What was your reaction when he told you he heard arrogance in the pauses?
I thought it was good-natured. I mean, yes, as we were saying before, any criticism your mind sort of latches onto. But he was giving me compliments and offering me a job. So it's funny how much people become actors, I found, because they have some need for validation. And then when you search for roles as an actor, you'll throw all of your validation out the window. You hear there's an audition for an arrogant loser. You're like, I'm an arrogant loser. I'm born to be an arrogant loser, because it's just this weird cycle or something, or circular logic. So yeah, at the time I was like, yeah, great, arrogant. Sure, that's me. I got it.
So you were not only playing Ryan, you were writing some of the episodes that he's in. So how did you shape the character in your role as a writer?
You know, it was a little complex, because sort of the writer's room etiquette was I didn't want to pitch for myself exactly. So it was really more when someone else had an idea for Ryan at the center of an episode, like in the episode The Fire or Initiation or Woof. Actually, I didn't write Woof, but the first two, The Fire or Initiation, they would just assign that script to me to write so I could sort of take it away. But I think, you know, it was really a couple of the younger writers, Lee Eisenberg and Gene Stupnitsky and Mindy, who really were excited to, you know, satirize the sort of swaggering young guy they knew, not just in me, but like, you know, that we all knew at that time. So they really wrote the more wicked aspects of Ryan.
Why don't we play a clip with the more wicked aspects of Ryan? This is your character, Ryan, and Mindy Kaling's character, Kelly Kapoor, have this on-again, off-again relationship, and she always wants to kind of get married and have children. And he's like, no, no. So this is an episode where, this is from season 5, and she's just broken up with her boyfriend and wants to be with you again. You've both just kissed. And then you say,
I can't do this.
Can't do what?
It's not fair to you. And it's really not fair to me.
Wait, what are you saying? I broke up with Daryl so I could be with you.
That was your choice. Don't put that on me. I'm just going on a little trip.
Can I come?
It's not that kind of trip. I'm going to Thailand with some friends from high school. Well, a high school. And if I don't do it now, I'll never get to go. And I'll always resent you for it. You don't want me to resent you, do you?
So you're dumping me?
Let's be adults about this. Let's have sex one more time. And if you have any extra cash, that would be amazing.
Okay.
What a creep you are.
Oh, that's brutal. Oh my God, I haven't heard that in all these years. That is brutal. It's like listening to, I would imagine, I've never fortunately gone through addiction, but when people listen to sort of or realize what they did in this completely different state of mind, you know, that's what it felt like to me hearing that.
It's, you know, how did really, I ever really get deep funny.
in that character? I know, but I remember he also, and I did write this line, that Ryan excused his own behavior to Kelly by saying, I think I never really processed 9/11. So yeah, there's a 9/11 joke that made its way in.
Yeah.
And I also had in the fire episode, I had Steve Carell say 9/11 to the firefighters to try to get there, to win them over. And I don't think it felt right, but it was Steve Carell who said, you know, I think if you'd been in New York that day, he said, it's very funny, but if you'd been in New York that day, it wouldn't feel the same to you. And I understood that.
So in the series, you had an on-again, off-again relationship with Mindy Kaling's character. And of course, in life, and I know you've been asked about this a lot, so forgive me for asking again. In life, you had an on-again, off-again relationship too. And you're still very close. You're the godfather to one of her children.
To both.
To both children, great. Did having that kind of on-again, off-again romantic relationship ever get in the way of the show?
No, I mean, I think it fueled the show in the sense that all of us were putting everything we had into the show every day. So if Mindy and I had a fight or an argument, other writers were taking notes, you know, or we would just improvise it on set. So, you know, none of us had lives. And I think that's why so many of us, including me and Mindy, became so close. You know, you go home at 2 a.m. or suddenly it's the weekend and you don't know anybody else. So you just keep hanging out with everybody. But yeah, she's one of the closest or the closest person in my life to this day.
So you'd have a fight and then would that turn into the funny version of the fight on the show?
Yeah. I mean, the whole reason our characters started dating on the show is because people, they couldn't get over this dynamic we had in the writer's room that neither of us realized was funny at all. And other people would laugh and shake their heads and we'd say, what? And they'd say, you too. And then before we knew it, you know, they had written us in as, you know, this horrible partnership.
So were you dating at the time?
You know, I think like Ryan and Kelly and like many people in their 20s, it depends who you ask and what hour you ask it at.
Right. What was it like when you shot the final episode of The Office? Were you glad it was ending? Was it really sad for you?
I cried. Yeah. It was hard. I mean, I think we were all so ready to be done with it, but because it had been so grueling for so long. But to actually, I'm getting choked up now, to actually, like the last shot of that I filmed was literally, this would be a better moment on television, Terry. like on the radio.
You don't get the same impact. Yeah.
I wish this were Barbara Walters and this were like a famous moment. But, you know, it was Mindy and I running off into the sunset together. It had a horribly dark undercurrent, which was that I was abandoning my baby that I had left at the wedding to run off with her. But, you know, I remember it was a sunset. It was Mindy. And, yeah, you know, it was the end. You know, it's sort of like, you know, it really blended the reality and the workplace, that Dunder Mifflin was where I worked for 9 years. And I had a lot of complaints about it and a lot of frustrations and a lot of, you know, disappointments and along with all of the, you know, ecstatic moments. But, you know, when it finally was over, it was sad. Yeah, it was really sad.
It has been such a pleasure to talk with you. I want to thank you so much for coming on our show.
You know, Mindy and I were talking a while ago, and she said, do people know when they go on Terry Gross's show that that's the interview that will be played when they die? So I don't mean to get morbid, but that's been in the back of my head. So I hope that I said some worthy things. Thank you so much, Terry.
BJ Novak created the new anthology series, The Premise, which is streaming on FX on Hulu. He co-starred in The Office as Ryan and was also a writer, director, and executive producer of the show. When TV networks and producers decide to remake an old TV show for a new era and generation, sometimes the results are bland and predictable, but other times the new versions are approached in imaginative ways that make them feel very much their own. Our TV critic David Bianculli has seen two new remakes that he says are valuable on their own merits because of some very significant major changes. One is HBO's new version of the 1970s Swedish miniseries Scenes from a Marriage, which premiered September 12th. The other is ABC's remake of its classic nostalgic sitcom about the 60s, The Wonder Years, which premiered last Wednesday. Here's David's review.
In 1988, ABC had so much faith in its new comedy series, The Wonder Years, that it premiered it right after that year's Super Bowl. It was an instant hit, and deservedly so. A young actor named Fred Savage played Kevin Arnold, a suburban white kid entering junior high school in the year 1968. Daniel Stern narrated the series as an adult Kevin looking back on that formative part of his youth. It was a great show from start to finish. And now, more than 30 years later, ABC has decided to remake it. And Fred Savage is back with the show, only this time as the show's director. This new version of The Wonder Years is still set in 1968, but this time in Montgomery, Alabama, focusing on a black family at that same point in the 60s. The 12-year-old boy, now named Dean, is played by Elijah Williams. And the narrator this time, as the adult Dean providing play-by-play of his own childhood, is Don Cheadle. If you doubt whether a new Wonder Years can work, as I did before seeing the pilot episode, drop the skepticism. It's wonderful. And Cheadle, providing narration and perspective, hits the perfect tone, just as Daniel Stern did in the original.
One thing about being 12 that hasn't changed over the decades is that it's around 12 where you figure out what your place is in the world. But being in my family made that hard. I'd never be as popular as my sister or as athletic as my brother, as smart as my mom or as bad as my dad. That's the problem with being the youngest. By the time you're born, all the good parts have been handed out.
Another terrific asset to this new Wonder Years series is the actor playing Dean's father. He's played by Dooley Hill from The West Wing and Psych. He manages to be very funny and very authoritative here, like the dad Terry Crews played in Chris Rock's nostalgic TV sitcom memoir, Everybody Hates Chris. This new Wonder Years resembles that show a bit too, but it's also got the sensibility and sensitivity of the original Wonder Years. Executive producers Lee Daniels and Saladin K. Patterson are exploring rather than avoiding the racial divide of 1968 and find their own perspective and touchstones, like Otis Redding singing A Change Is Gonna Come. But the show at its core still is about family and growing up and unexpected triumphs and tragedies and how everything at that age seems so crucial and confusing. Because it is. Another new remake of an old TV series is vastly different, but once again takes a new approach and ends up being surprisingly compelling. It's HBO's new Scenes from a Marriage, based on the 1970s Swedish miniseries written and directed by Ingmar Bergman. That TV drama, starring Liv Ullmann and Erland Josephson, was edited down into an international movie version, one that many film critics, including Roger Ebert, called the best film of the year. But the superior unedited miniseries version eventually was imported to the States by PBS, which televised it in 1977, in its original Swedish, with subtitles. For HBO, this new Scenes from a Marriage stars Jessica Chastain and Oscar Isaac as the married couple whose lives are visited at certain points. It's written and directed by Hagai Levi, who created The Affair and the original Israeli series on which another HBO show, In Treatment, was based. He's very faithful in concept to the original Scenes from a Marriage, which, before diving into the intense, lengthy scenes between husband and wife, also began with the married couple describing themselves to a therapist, or, in this case, a researcher, gathering data on seemingly successful married couples.
I'm a father to Ava, mm-hmm. who's 4 years old, as you know. I'm an academic. I should have said that first, actually. It's mm-hmm. a big part of my self-definition. Mm-hmm. I teach in the philosophy department at Tufts. Mm-hmm. What else? I'm 41. I'm a Democrat.
Yeah.
I'm an asthmatic.
Whoa, you feel your asthma defines you?
Yeah.
Really? Yeah.
Well, if you go through your whole life threatened with the possibility of suffocating, then yeah, you know, becomes part of your self-definition.
Okay.
What?
No, is nothing, that, babe. Yeah. It's what? It's interesting, really.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay. Cool.
And Mira, how would you...
Right, I'm a woman. I'm married.
Correct.
I am a mother. I mm-hmm. am 40. Not quite, but that's definitely my self-definition, 40. I'm in tech. I'm VP of product management at Horizon. I know that doesn't mean much to most people, but
you
know.
She's a big shot. Yeah. Trust me.
Okay, what else? I'm a mother, obviously.
You said that. Don't worry.
Oh, good.
The first Scenes from a Marriage arrived on television when reality TV, with shows like An American Family, was in its infancy. It was, at the time, an amazingly raw drama. And this new incarnation captures that, with scenes that build so slowly and naturally, most of them in unbroken chunks of real time, that they're almost devastating to watch. And the one key alteration made for this new version, and it's a hugely significant one, is that this time, it's the woman, not the man, whose actions most affect the marriage. Both Scenes from a Marriage and The Wonder Years are faithful enough to be familiar, yet different enough to be fresh.
David Bianculli is a professor of television history at Rowan University in New Jersey. My guest Colson Whitehead won a Pulitzer Prize for each of his last two novels, The Underground Railroad and The Nickel Boys. The Underground Railroad is about a 15-year-old enslaved girl who escapes a brutal Georgia plantation. It was adapted into an Amazon TV series. The Nickel Boys was based on the story of the Dozier School for Boys in northern Florida, a reform school infamous for its mistreatment and brutal punishment of the boys who were sent there, and for the buried bodies discovered on its grounds. There's many sides to Colson Whitehead's writing. He also wrote a novel about a plague where everyone who's infected becomes a zombie, and wrote a memoir about playing poker. Now he's written a crime novel called Harlem Shuffle, set in Harlem between 1959 and 64. The main character, Ray Carney, owns a furniture store on 125th Street in Harlem, but he has a sideline trafficking in stolen goods as a fence, or as he prefers to think of it, he was a middleman, part of the natural flow of goods in and out and through people's lives, from here to there, a churn of property that he helped facilitate. Nothing like his father, who was more of a full-time crook, with crooked friends. Ray is also a family man. He and his wife are expecting their second child when the novel begins. The novel is about his dual life, class divisions within Harlem, and the crimes of the elite compared to the crimes on Ray's level. Colson Whitehead, welcome back to Fresh Air. I love this novel. Thanks for writing it, and thanks for coming back to our show.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. It's very exciting.
I want to start by asking you to do a reading. And just to set this up a little bit, so, you know, Ray Carney is a fence, and he basically deals with pretty small-time stuff. But his cousin, who's more of a full-time crook, and this is a cousin who Ray has bailed out all of the cousin's life, the cousin Freddie comes to him and says, look, we're doing a heist of a safe at the Hotel Teresa. And you describe this as the Waldorf of Harlem, and it was a real hotel. And Ray thinks, wow, robbing that is kind of like pissing on the Statue of Liberty. And he thinks this job is just like too big for him. It's like wrong for him. So I'd like you to do a reading about Ray Carney's reaction to his cousin's proposal about fencing the stolen jewels from this heist after the heist is done.
All righty. Even if he were crooked enough for his cousin's proposition, he'd have the contacts to handle a haul from the Hotel Teresa. 300 rooms, who knows how many guests locking up valuables and cash and safe deposit boxes behind reception. He wouldn't know what to do with it. Neither would his man Buxbaum down on Canal have a coronary if Carney walked in with that kind of weight. Carney was only slightly bent when it came to being crooked, in practice and ambition. The odd piece of jewelry, the electronic appliances Freddie and then a few other local characters brought by the store, he could justify. Nothing major. Nothing that attracted undue attention to his store, the front he put out to the world. If he got a thrill out of transforming these ill-gotten goods into legit merchandise, a zap charge in his blood like he'd plugged into a socket, he was in control of it, and not the other way around. Dizzying and powerful as it was. Everyone had secret corners and alleys that no one else saw. What mattered were your major streets and boulevards, the stuff that showed up on other people's maps of you. The thing inside him that gave a yell or tug or shout now and again was not the same thing his father had, that sickness drawing every moment into its service. The sickness Freddie ministered to more and more. Carney had a bent to his personality. How could he not, growing up with a father like that? You had to know your limits as a man and master them.
Thanks for reading that. That's Colson Whitehead reading from his new novel, Harlem Shuffle. So after writing novels with really big social themes, The Underground Railroad and The Nickel Boys, why did you want to write a crime novel set in Harlem in 1959 to 64?
Yeah, well, I usually do mix it up, write a serious book or more sober book and then something lighter with more jokes. I originally was going to follow up The Underground Railroad with Harlem Shuffle, but then after the last election, presidential election, I had to sort out my feelings about being in America. Are we heading in the right direction? Am I optimistic or pessimistic? And so the philosophical dilemma of the two boys and the Nickel Boys was more compelling. But that meant when I finished that book, I had all these notes for Harlem Shuffle, and I was eager to get back to it. As for the why, about 7 years ago, I was trying to think of a movie to rent that night. And I was thinking about how much I like heist movies and thinking how much fun, you know, the directors and writers must have put it all together. And I asked myself, you know, why can't I do that? And the answer is, no reason at all. Why not?
You told the New York Times that you think everyone has a criminal side, even if it's just stealing a pack of gum. So, of course, I have to ask, you feel that way yourself?
Mostly when I was stealing Wi-Fi before everyone had passwords, like 15 years ago. So
that is truly a victimless crime unless you're hacking the person you're stealing from.
But
you're freeloading.
Their streaming is slowing down because I'm, you know, stealing your bad bandwidth. No, I'm very much a Boy Scout, so I have to use the powers of my imagination to figure out Carney and these other characters.
As we've mentioned, Ray Carney is the son of a crook, of a full-time crook, and Carney's wife is from a middle-class family. Her parents live on Stryver's Row in Harlem. Her father is a successful accountant for successful businessmen, politicians, doctors, and lawyers in Harlem. And he belongs to this club for the elite black community in Harlem called the Dumas. Am I pronouncing right? Dumas Club?
I think if you, it's named after Alexander Dumas, but I figure these guys say Dumas. That seems like a mid-century Harlem okay. way to say it. So I mentally think of Dumas.
Yeah. And so you describe it in the book as a paper bag club. Would you explain what that means?
There were various social clubs for well-to-do black folks in the 19th and 20th centuries. And you could only enter them if you had a, upstanding job. And also if you were lighter than a paper bag. And so the paper bag test meant that if you were darker skinned, you were not accepted and you're not going to join their little club.
So there was that much colorism in the elite black clubs?
Yeah, and, I can't speak for all of them, but that was definitely a real force, that sort of social stratification. Where are you from? Are you first generation college or third generation? Do you come from a long line of free black folks? Or have you just come from Alabama, last year? Now you're trying to make it and try to be one of us. And so colorism and class stratification exists everywhere. And, the second part of the book is pulling back to see these other social forces that are affecting Carney. He has a bad background, he's darker skinned, and how does he navigate this hoity-toity privileged world?
Can you talk about how Harlem has changed from the time the novel is set, 59 to 64, to now, because I imagine you spent a lot of time in Harlem while you were writing the novel, even though it has changed.
Yeah, I mean, location scouting and, finding places for Carney to live. That was a great, fun thing to do. I lived in Harlem until I was about six on 139th and Riverside. So my first New York is a very gritty, dirty New York. But for research, I would you go back to newspapers, and there are books about the Hotel Teresa. And then also, if you go to YouTube and put in 1960s Harlem, some amateur filmmaker from back then has uploaded his reel of walking down 125th Street in 64, 67. And for me, I look at all the signs in the background. I'm like, oh, okay, a hamburger was 35 cents, or what kind of hat is that? And then I research what kind of clothes they're wearing. And so when I compare the footage to what I see now, and those tiny storefronts are now big box chains, it's Chuck E. Cheese, big Nike store, Magic Johnson Theaters, the footprint of retail is quite different. And as in a lot of different places in the country, you can see in the background those painted signs, like on the fifth floor of a building, Sammy's shoe store. And so if you look up at certain tall buildings, you can see that old sort of vanished New York in the same way you can see that old vanished Chicago or Seattle. But on a street level, it's the very shiny retail we have now. And so it's very stark when I'm walking around thinking what Carney's going to do next. And then there's a reality of 21st century retail staring me in the face.
Tell us about the Hotel Teresa and its place in Harlem.
So a lot of the other things in the book I had no knowledge of. And so I'd walk past that building, many times in my life. It was a whites only hotel, and then had to be desegregated because the neighborhood changed. And it became the place to stay. If you were Joe Louis or Billie Holiday or Cab Calloway, you would stay there if you were in town, be seen at the cocktail bar, maybe keep an apartment upstairs. When a big band came to town, they alert the media and there'd be this big group of paparazzi and all the folks from the neighborhood would come to see who was stepping off the bus. And I read that and thought, that's a good place for a heist. It just seemed it was such a holy place that it could be a site for some of the action in the book. And, I had to think of these different robbers' reactions. And so Miami Joe, who plans the heist at the Hotel Teresa, he's come from the South. He's a new arrival. People look down upon him. And it's not necessarily because he's from the South. I mean, he has a bad personality, but he takes it personally. And so robbing the Hotel Teresa would be, you know, sticking his finger in the eye of this Harlem elite who looks down upon him.
Mount Morris Park, which is now called Marcus Garvey Park, is a place where bodies are buried.
Yes.
In the novel. Like, if you've killed somebody, that's the place to hide the body. And a lot of our listeners who aren't familiar with Harlem might know Mount Morris Park, now Marcus Garvey Park, from the Questlove documentary about the 1969 Harlem Cultural Festival, because that festival was held in Mount Morris Park. So what do you know? I mean, was it really, is this part of like the park's lore, or is it like really true that their bodies were buried there? What's the story?
Not buried, but dumped. And so—
Dumped, yes.
Yeah. So I went to newspapers for what's happening in the city, and primary sources are really just great for me to, you know, suck up slang and culture. So whether it was William Burroughs, who has a book called Junkie, and it's about being a junkie and small-time hustler in Harlem, all over Manhattan, in the 40s and 50s, giving me the language of the small-time white hustlers, or the wife of Bumpy Johnson helping me out. Bumpy Johnson was a big Harlem mobster, but his wife, you know, to correct the record from all these lies about Bumpy Johnson, described the culture of the time, the criminal culture. And so that's how I learned about how numbers rackets worked and numbers banks versus number runners and stuff like that. And she talks about how if you beat someone up but didn't necessarily want them to die, you would drive past Harlem Hospital, dump them on the foot of the emergency room doors and keep driving. And if you killed them, you would dump them in Mount Morris. And basically it seemed like so many people were dumping bodies there that you had to like take a number every Saturday night to find space to dump the person you'd killed.
You wrote a novel called Zone One about a plague, and the people infected with the plague become zombies. And after this kind of plague and zombie apocalypse, the survivors have to kind of remake the world. Did you think about that a lot when COVID started? Because it's a plague. And we're not turning into zombies, but, you know, we're certainly having our share of problems.
It is a plague, and definitely I was thinking about it in a very just sort of depressing way. Just being locked down and remembering this or that passage from the book. But mostly I was just sort of angry about the things I didn't get right. You know, the characters in the book are called sweepers, and they go door to door, retrieving dead bodies and taking out the last of the zombies so that they can restart civilization. So I didn't realize how much toilet paper they would find when they went to these different folks' apartments. So
the hoarders.
So the hoarders, yeah. So that was a failure of my imagination. And then secondly, I had no idea that people would say, oh, the zombie virus, it's just like the flu. It doesn't really matter. Or I'm not going to get the zombie vaccine. You know, the depths of the denial and psychosis around vaccines, I couldn't foresee. So if I did it over again, definitely there would be people who would resist the zombie virus, the zombie vaccine, and suffer the consequences, and which would be unfortunate.
I hope you've managed to stay well through the pandemic.
Yes, for, you know, the early part of lockdown was, are we safe? Is everybody psychologically safe? And then how can we sustain a consistent Wi-Fi signal for the kids? And then how can I find an hour to work and finish off a Harlem Shuffle? So, you know, I count myself as very lucky that we made it through the way we did.
In one of our previous interviews, you told me that you almost saw yourself as a shut-in because you're always writing and reading.
Yes. Yes, on social media, so writers would say, lockdown's not that different than, you know, the way things were before. You know, writers proud to have been training for lockdown life for decades and decades, which was true. But also, you know, some of my writer friends had younger kids, you know, one-year-olds, and it was different sort of corralling them and finding the time to work. And so everyone had their own accommodation with the problem.
You also told me that you had zombie dreams for about 30 years, and not constantly, but it was the theme of some of your dreams for 30 years. And at the time we spoke, which was a few years ago, you were having those dreams about once a year. Are you still having zombie dreams, and did COVID make them more frequent or more crazy?
I was a big horror fan, and so I saw Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead very early, and depending on my psychological weather, I would have dreams where zombies catch me, they're slow, they're fast, they talk, I escape, I don't. And that really did end with writing Zone 1. They went from monthly to once a year. And they're still once a year. I mean, I have this thing where if I write about something, I definitely kind of exercise it. And so, which is good in some ways, like zombie dreams. I wrote a piece about fried chicken last year and cooking fried chicken. It was very detailed. And then since then, I haven't been able to eat fried chicken. So the writing cure, sometimes good and sometimes bad. Can I tell you about this weird thing, Terry?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So obviously the Fresh Air interview is revered around the world. And so whatever I say to you now becomes the template for other people's interviews for years and years. So whatever you ask me, will come up, they'll steal the question, but also any tangent. And so, if I'm like, oh, and then in the summer I used to ride my bike and it was great. 3 years from now in like Finland, some journalist will be like, Coulson, tell me about the bike you had.
Really?
Yes, they just go through the transcript and then they'll steal your questions. And then also, but they'll also steal stuff that just comes up in conversation. So I'm like, what bike? What are you talking about? And then they'll come clean. It's the first draft of history. So.
Coulson Whitehead, it's been really great to have you back on the show. And I want to say again, I really love your new book. So thank you.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
Coulson Whitehead's new novel is called Harlem Shuffle. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. I'm Terry Gross.